Today, the vice president of Egypt announced that because he was slightly wounded, he would not become the interim president. That job will go to the Speaker of the Parliament. Vice President Mubarak is, however, likely to become Egypt's next permanent president. The slight shift in procedure isn't exactly what's set out in Egypt's constitution, but Fawzi Najjar, professor of social science at Michigan State University, says that doesn't mean the transition will be a rough one.
According to the constitution, in case of death or resignation or anything like this, the vice president will become automatically an acting president.
Yes.
And in a period of not more than 60 days, the People's Assembly should nominate a candidate or candidates and submit the names to the public in a referendum.
That raises several questions. The first of them is, who is this Mr. Mubarak?
Mubarak was in the 1973 war. He was the Air Force Chief of Staff. He's an Army General by training. In 1975, Sadat made him vice president.
What do we know about Mr. Mubarak's own personal politics?
Well, he was here, you know, in the United States 2 days ago.
I know that.
Yeah, and he met with the president. He is a fairly colorless person, I would say, in terms of public image. He rarely speaks in public. And I don't think he's well-known outside Egypt, even in Egypt, except in certain circles. Of course, he's now well-known, but at the beginning, he was not. And basically, he is, I would say, identified, at least in broad outlines, with the Sadat policy. He is fairly pro-American, you could say.
Does he support President Sadat's initiative for peace with Israel and the Camp David agreements?
For all practical purposes, he has been identified with Sadat, so I assume he does support that policy.
Professor Najjar, President Sadat really liked to think of Egypt being a democracy, didn't he? But it wasn't really, was it?
Well, there were, in Egypt, the democratic institutions, like a People's Assembly and a constitution and the separation of power and all these, features of a democratic system. But Mr. Sadat did not believe that the Egyptians could take a big dose of democracy at one time, that he was going to introduce it gradually, because he always mentioned this point, that democracy means responsibility and control. It does not mean that people should do everything they please.
But then he did some things like that recent sort of plebiscite on approving his crackdown on the dissidents. That sounded so much like the action almost of a totalitarian regime.
Well, not exactly, because according to Article 74 of the Constitution, he has the right to do so, and this was copied from Article 36 of the French Constitution of 1958.
Uh-huh.
In a sense, he is imitating de Gaulle to go over to the people and derive his public support by bypassing the already established, constitutional institutions. And especially in periods of immediate danger, where you can't wait for democratic procedures to operate efficiently.
Hmm. Yeah. So he really felt he was moving his country toward democracy?
Very much so. He bragged about this all the time, as a matter of fact, and prided himself that he had the only democracy in the Arab world, which may be true.
Michigan State University professor Fawzi Najjar spoke to us from East Lansing. He's a frequent visitor to Egypt and an expert on that country's constitutional development.
Jacob Javits, a former member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, says that the future for peace in the Middle East depends to a great extent on whether President Sadat's successor follows in Sadat's footsteps, whether he's a good politician, a risk-taker like Sadat, a gambler. It also depends, Javits says, on what the United States does now.
I don't think that we can assume that the prospects for peace are suddenly dimmer than they were materially after this first shock is absorbed. But probably they are. And the question then is, what do we throw into the make weight? And I believe what the United States can do is to make it very clear that it defines its partnership and that we will continue to make our material support and our diplomatic support available to Egypt and to Israel in terms of continuing that process.
And you're talking about economic as well as military support.
I'm talking about economic primarily and military to deal with any overweening threat to Egypt's security, for example, from the Soviet Union.
Senator Javits, how bright, though, were the prospects for peace between Israel and Egypt?
Given time, some result could have been achieved. And the question was, would time be given, or would the pressures on Sadat make it impossible? Well, the pressure turned out to be his mortality, so we don't know what will ensue.
But we are also talking about the death of a man who had essentially wielded enormous personal power and placed himself in a situation in which he was isolated from the Arab world. What sort of a threat now does that pose, the fact that he had such strong enemies in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq?
I doubt very much that they would take a chance on invading Egypt. Indeed, if they did, it might result in really rallying the country behind Mubarak or some other leader.
What about the possibility of Soviet mischief-making in the area?
Well, Soviet mischief-making goes on all the time, but I do not wish to engender ideas or suspicions which don't exist, except to mention the possibility because of the obscurity of how this occurred.
From your reading of the Reagan administration's dealing with Egypt and with Israel, and the new hardline policy that they have been creating against the Soviets, is this going to exacerbate an already difficult situation?
Well, I think the Soviet Union will tell you it will. But I think the Soviet is so suspicious that this isn't going to add or subtract.
How confident are you, Senator Javits, that the Reagan administration will continue to provide Egypt with the kind of support that you feel is so essential?
I think this administration will, and the Congress will, so long as there's no likelihood of Egypt falling off from this peace process.
What about a worst-case scenario, the idea that someone who succeeds him will not share those interests, will not share those goals, will give in to the kind of factionalism that exists already inside Egypt?
Well, then we're put back to square one when Nasser had the country full of Soviet technicians, and they got thrown out. But while they were there, we were pretty well shut out, and we managed to survive, and Israel managed to survive. So I don't think that's can be written down as the end, even if it should happen. And we certainly should move heaven and earth to see that it doesn't.
Former New York Senator Jacob Javits.
I guess at first I wasn't surprised, because when I think of the Middle East, I think it's an explosive area. And Sadat was open for that. But I was shocked and surprised, saddened too by it. Well, not really surprised, but saddened by it.
Oh, I think I was just numb, completely numb, dispirited, and depressed.
I was shocked. I always find that whenever a person is out promoting world peace and trying to settle problems of the world, they're the ones that get nipped. It's always those people. You never hear of Idi Amin getting it. You always hear about the people who are promoting world peace that get killed.
I thought it was tragic. It raised many questions in my mind as to the situation in the Mideast. And I just wondered its position now, what Egypt's position was going to be with Israel, whether it was solely dependent upon Sadat Begin rapport.
I felt like he was the key to the peace process in the Middle East. I don't believe anyone else would have made the move he did 4 years ago to do that, and I feel like he was still probably the, of all the leaders who were involved, the most solidifying of the group, showed the most courage.
The people of Ames, Iowa, reacting to the assassination of Anwar Sadat in conversations with reporter Marianne Spellman.
In the middle of the afternoon today, President Reagan read a statement about the death of President Sadat. He said that Sadat's courage and skill reaped a harvest of life for his nation and the world. This evening, the administration is assessing the implications of Sadat's death with the president's top foreign policy advisors. NPR's Ted Clark is at the White House.
Spokesman David Gergen said, "This government is pleased that the Egyptian government is pursuing its constitutional processes with regard to succession. And we are pleased," he added, "by the continuity of Egyptian policy, including the continued dedication of that nation to the Camp David Accords." Gergen indicated the U.S. has received assurances from several sources that Egypt remains committed to Camp David. Gergen was not willing to discuss the effect of the assassination on the administration's efforts to win congressional approval for the $8.5 billion Saudi arms sale. However, he did say, in the president's view, this tragedy in no way lessens the urgency of that sale. Indeed, it only increases the urgency. He said it's in everyone's interest to strengthen the forces of moderation in that area, and Saudi Arabia is one of the moderate forces. U.S. military forces in the area have been notified of these events, and they are taking what Gergen called necessary prudent precautions. He declined the opportunity to warn other nations at this time not to interfere in Egyptian affairs, and he also declined to discuss whether U.S. intelligence agencies had heard of any plots recently to attempt to kill President Sadat. No decisions have been made yet as to who will represent the United States at Sadat's funeral. I'm Ted Clark at the White House.
Radio Cairo says the funeral of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat will be held on Saturday. The 62-year-old Arab leader, the architect of the country's peace treaty with Israel, was assassinated today as he reviewed a military parade. Sadat died at a hospital where he underwent emergency surgery for chest and shoulder wounds. The Egyptian leadership immediately convened in an emergency cabinet meeting, and Vice President Mubarak announced that elections will be held in 2 months. Mubarak is virtually assured of winning. A principal concern following Sadat's death is the Middle East peace process with Israel. Egypt's U.S. Ambassador Gorbal assured today it will continue as he paid tribute to the late president.
Egypt has lost a courageous leader, and the world has lost a great statesman. The government, under the leadership of Vice President Hosni Mubarak, is in full control of the situation. The peace process under Camp David will remain the adhered policy of the country.
President Reagan eulogized Sadat as a humanitarian unafraid to make peace, and Israeli Prime Minister Begin mourned the loss of his partner in peace. The Pentagon has directed U.S. forces in the Middle East to boost security following the assassination of Sadat. The Defense Department says forces in the region are taking prudent precautions as they would in any unusual situation. I'm Richard Harris in Washington.
Since the Reagan administration came to office, it's experienced crisis after crisis in the Middle East. But clearly, the death of Anwar Sadat is the most profound to date. Sadat was the anchor of American hopes for a comprehensive peace in the Middle East, and Egypt has become the kind of strategic ally the United States particularly needed in the region after the fall of the Shah of Iran. In the aftermath of the assassination, the United States government must review its Middle East policy. NPR's William Drummond reports.
The administration's plan was to get the Middle East peace process back in full swing by early next year. First Sadat, and then Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin visited Washington to hold talks with President Reagan. Recently, the talks on Palestinian autonomy resumed. Now it appears that all those plans are on hold. But the disruption goes deeper than that. In the 8 years since the October 1973 war in the Middle East, the United States and Egypt have gone from being estranged to being fast friends. U.S. Ambassador to Egypt Alfred Atherton was asked a few weeks ago if the new U.S. commitment to Egyptian economic development might produce a strong reaction from conservative Egyptian elements.
I would not say I was concerned about the commitment. I think that the commitment is based upon some very broadly shared interests, and I think it is very broadly based in the support of public opinion in both Egypt and in the United States. And that's very important, that it not simply be the policy of one person or the policy simply of a small leadership group.
Atherton's assessment will clearly be put to the test now. Sadat's successors will have to decide whether they want to continue to provide military facilities to the United States and to keep the doors open to U.S. government aid and private business investment. Atherton conceded that the U.S. presence is a volatile issue.
The reaction of other countries to our presence, and it's always a sensitive problem when you are dealing in a developing country, a country that is basically a poor country, and we are obviously developed and affluent. It isn't just a perception of the numbers of Americans in a particular country. Our numbers in Egypt are up to perhaps 8,000 or 9,000, counting the private American community. Not too large in a country of almost 43 million people.
U.S. Ambassador to Cairo Alfred Atherton speaking a few weeks ago. The other important role Egypt has played is in the peace process. It is the only Arab country to make peace with Israel. And the United States had hoped that other Arab states, such as the Saudis and the Jordanians, would follow Sadat's example and come to the bargaining table. Now the question is whether Egypt itself will stay at that table. William Quant was President Carter's Middle East specialist on the National Security Council staff. Quant says he expects Egypt's policies to remain true to Sadat's ideals.
The likely leaders in Egypt seem to me to be fairly strongly committed to Sadat's policies. They may conduct themselves a bit differently, with a little less flair, a little less daring, but it's very, very difficult for any Egyptian leader now to turn back the clock entirely.
Quant says that he would also not be surprised to see some efforts by other Arab countries to repair relations with Egypt. Most observers think that Sadat's death will prove to be a setback for the peace process. But remember, this is the Middle East. Nobody would have predicted that it was out of the October 1973 war that the real momentum for peace began. If Egypt is able to regain some influence in the Arab world and still continue in its peacemaking role with Israel, Sadat's death would not have occurred in vain. In Washington, I'm William Drummond.
Leaders in the U.S. Senate mourned Anwar Sadat today. In statement after statement, senators lauded his initiatives in bringing peace to the Middle East. But just beneath the personal regret expressed by many senators are questions about the matter that they are now preparing to consider. It's this: should sophisticated weapons be sold to Saudi Arabia? And how does the absence of Anwar Sadat affect that decision? NPR's Linda Wertheimer reports from Capitol Hill.
Most members of the Senate Council calm, waiting an interval to assess the loss of Egypt's president, to think about the implications of his death. Howard Baker of Tennessee, the majority leader of the Senate who supports the president's efforts to sell arms to Saudi Arabia.
I think we ought to observe this moment to memorialize a man who gave so much in his quest for peace, and postpone and defer our concern about this aspect of American foreign policy until we've had a chance to digest the enormity of this event that occurred today with the death of President Sadat.
The minority leader, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, had similar cautions.
This is a time not to reach for hasty judgments. We should try to understand what the implications will be.
Senator Henry Jackson, Democrat of Washington, a supporter of Israel who opposes the sale, says AWACS should be set aside for a time.
One bullet could make the difference between peace and conflict in the Middle East. One bullet could take away from the Western world a voice of reason and a voice of sense.
Senator John Glenn of Ohio, who's been working with the administration to find a compromise on AWACS, judged that in these first hours, senators hesitating over their decision might find cause to go either way.
I think it's very difficult to say. I think with some people, the AWACS sale might be affected by this in that it would indicate some instability in that region and might harden their views as far as what they would demand before that sensitive equipment was transferred into that area. For others, might react the other way and say it's even more important that we now go ahead with the sale.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, one of the senators who announced he could not support the president, decided today that Sadat's death must change his vote.
I've come to the conclusion if there's ever a time to support the president of the United States, right now is that time. And so I'm going to change, and I'm going to support President Reagan on the AWACS decision, and I hope that all my colleagues will consider doing that as well.
Senators who've been counting votes on the AWACS sale say it is simply too early to tell if votes are shifting. The count remains against the sale right now. Another senator has decided to vote no, and only Hatch has decided to change his vote to yes. Although a number of senators said they would support the president if he wishes to withdraw the measure from the Senate for a time, none of the leaders appeared to believe such a move is likely. The Senate is scheduled to debate AWACS on the 20th of this month. I'm Linda Wertheimer at the Capitol.
The leader of America's closest ally in the Arab world was assassinated today. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was gunned down by rebel soldiers as he reviewed a military parade in a Cairo suburb. The BBC's Bob Jobbins watched the attack unfold.
As jets flew overhead, a group of soldiers jumped from a truck taking part in the parade. They threw grenades at the reviewing stand and opened fire with automatic rifles from close range. The bullets swept through the densely packed group of senior ministers and military leaders. As the attackers sprinted towards the president, firing as they ran, there was a moment of stunned silence before security forces returned their fire, and the watching crowd dived for safety. Troops and security men quickly restored order, and of the six attackers, all were either shot or detained. Among them were at least two officers. Bob Jobbins, BBC, Cairo.
In addition to Sadat, a score of other top dignitaries, including the Egyptian defense minister, were wounded. Three American military observers were also injured, but none seriously. The Egyptian people learned that Sadat died in a nationally broadcast address from Vice President Hosni Mubarak, but only after 5 hours of official silence. His eyes swelling with tears, Mubarak said the president was killed by criminal, treacherous hands. Immediately, the Egyptian people left their homes and headed to the mosques to pray for Sadat's soul. Cairo Radio says a state funeral will be held on Saturday. Two exiled Egyptian groups and a Lebanese-based group claimed responsibility for the assassination. One of the Egyptian groups is headed by a former Egyptian chief of staff who appeared on Libyan television tonight calling Sadat a traitor. Libya and Egypt are archenemies, and French television tonight aired a Libyan film showing hundreds of people laughing in the streets of Tripoli celebrating Sadat's death. Secretary of State Haig hinted tonight that such propaganda had been distributed before the murder, and Washington Senator Henry Jackson says all this points to a suspect.
I was interested in the fact that Libya announced his death early. They have no diplomatic representatives in Cairo. They must have a good radio.
Egyptian sources say army troops along the country's western border with Libya have been put on alert. The Pentagon has ordered the Rapid Deployment Force to increase its readiness and directed U.S. forces in the Middle East to boost security precautions. Those Middle East troops include 4,000 Marines aboard ships in the Mediterranean. Tonight, Vice President Mubarak announced that the Speaker of the Egyptian Parliament, Sufi Abu Taleb, will serve as president for the next 60 days. His first order was to declare a state of emergency and ban all street demonstrations for a full year. As Morris Gindi reports from Cairo, it's Vice President Mubarak who will likely succeed Sadat.
Moving fast to avoid any power vacuum, the ruling National Democratic Party has nominated Vice President Hosni Mubarak to succeed the slain President Anwar Sadat. Mubarak, who is 53, held the vice presidency since 1975, and it was an open secret that Sadat had been grooming him for the top post eventually. The National Democratic Party, created by Sadat 2 years ago, controlled 330 out of Parliament's 392 seats, and it is a foregone conclusion the House will approve his nomination for the presidency. Under the Constitution, the nomination then goes to the nation in a referendum for endorsement. Morris Gindi in Cairo.
President Reagan, who met with Sadat in August here in Washington, said America has lost a close friend. Mankind has lost a champion of peace. Here's NPR's White House reporter, Ted Clark.
The president did not have official confirmation of Sadat's death until the announcement was read over Egyptian TV and carried live on American networks. Then Mr. Reagan read a statement on the north portico of the White House.
Anwar Sadat was admired and loved by the people of America. His death today, an act of infamy, cowardly infamy, fills us with horror.
Later this afternoon, the administration praised what spokesman David Gergen called Egypt's continuing dedication to the Camp David Accords. Gergen indicated the White House has received several assurances that Egypt remains committed to Camp David. He would not discuss the impact Sadat's death will have on efforts to win congressional approval for the sale of AWACS radar planes to Saudi Arabia. But Gergen did say the assassination in no way lessens the urgency of the sale. Indeed, it only increases that urgency. I'm Ted Clark at the White House.
Many in Congress say Sadat's death is all the more reason to reject the AWACS sale because it shows just how unstable the Middle East can be. But Senate Majority Leader Baker is calling for a moratorium on AWACS debate until, in Baker's words, Congress has time to digest the enormity of this event. In Plains, Georgia today, former President Carter called Sadat one of his closest personal friends.
When he was here in Plains just a few weeks ago, he told me that he hoped to step down as president of Egypt next year, that he thought his work was basically completed, that he hoped that Vice President Mubarak might take his place, that his contribution to world peace would still continue.
Carter says he'll attend Sadat's funeral on Saturday in Cairo. President Reagan has not made a final decision. Israeli Prime Minister Begin was stunned by today's news, and he visibly shook as he proclaimed that Sadat had been murdered by the enemies of peace. Begin says he lost not only a partner in the peace process, but a friend. A major concern on the financial markets today was that Sadat's death could lead to political unrest in Egypt and threaten the supply of Middle East oil. NPR's business correspondent Robert Krulwich has a report.
Traders on Wall Street today reacted to the assassination by selling shares in oil companies that have major interests in the Middle East. Standard Oil of Indiana was hard hit because of its fields in Egypt. Companies with mostly American or Canadian oil fields, like Pennzoil or Phillips Petroleum, sold very strongly today, so strongly that the market went up for the first few hours after the assassination, but finished a little off. The Dow dropped 3.5 points. Gold did well, jumping $15. Silver was up. Commodities generally went up, as normally happens in times of political uncertainty. I'm Robert Krulwich in New York.
And in Washington, I'm Richard Harris.
Several representatives from the Irish Republic were in Egypt today, in the reviewing stand when President Sadat was assassinated. One dignitary who escaped unharmed in Cairo was James Tully, the Irish defense minister, even though he was barely 10 feet from Sadat. Tully told Tom McCarran of the Irish Broadcasting Network what he saw.
We got an invitation to the parade, and naturally we were glad to see the spectacle. And I was surprised to find that I got a seat in the front row five from Sadat.
What happened when the soldiers opened fire? Did anybody fire back at them?
The funny thing about it was that it appeared to me like an hour, but it must have been a couple of minutes, there appeared to be no organized resistance. No organized security.
Well, what happened then after the president was hit?
Tom, I was lying flat on my mouth or nose on the ground along with about 1,000 other people scattered all over the place, and we didn't put up our head until the firing stopped.
Well, tell me, Minister, apart from the president, did you see any or many other casualties?
Well, the man who was sitting between me and the president, with 3 down from him, appeared, he fell. Before I went down, he appeared to fall, and a number of other people were lying all over the place and were being carried away, and I saw a number of people with bullet wounds in their heads and their hands, and blood coming out of their clothing. It appeared that the attackers fired indiscriminately into the sand.
They did fire indiscriminately?
Oh, they did, yes.
And you don't know what happened to them after that?
I don't know.
Well, Minister, can you tell me what it was like during those moments? It must have been very frightening.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. The thing that I was wondering about was why the security people went overpowering them, because there were literally thousands of army and police people all over the place.
Irish Defense Minister James Tully speaking with reporter Tom McCarran.
Israel will be directly affected by the death of Anwar Sadat. Reporter Peretz Kidron found a variety of reactions in Israel to the assassination. Though many Israelis see Sadat as the man who made the peace after the 1973 war, others see him as the man who started that war, and still others hold him responsible for Israel's pledge to withdraw from the Sinai. But no matter what their position, most of the people on Jerusalem's streets today seemed anxious about the future.
I don't know what it's going to be.
What do you think will happen now with the peace process?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Do you think we're going to have another war?
I hope not, but I don't know. If Sadat is not there, we don't know what it's going to be.
Most of the passers-by in the streets of Jerusalem were unusually reluctant to speak to the mic, a mark of their uncertainty and confusion. One young officer in uniform didn't seem sorry about the death of Sadat, the man who symbolized the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty and the resultant surrender of Sinai. The young soldier made his comment in Hebrew, "We'd be better off with a real war rather than with this so-called peace." A similar remark came from right-wing Knesset member Geula Cohen, who made no effort to conceal her satisfaction as she reminded an Israel radio reporter that Sadat had met his end on the anniversary of his 1973 attack on Israel. Cohen added that her nationalist Triar faction would demand an emergency meeting of the Israeli parliament to delay Israel's withdrawal from Sinai. "The bullet struck at the withdrawal," she remarked cheerfully. In response, left-wing leader Meir Pa'il noted that Israeli fanatics were joining their Arab counterparts in rejoicing over Sadat's death. The Peace Now movement, which organized mass rallies to support the peace talks, mourned the death of Sadat, the man of peace who had the courage to break through the wall of Arab enmity to Israel. Former Defense Minister Asa Weitzman, intimately associated with the peace talks and a personal friend of Sadat, recalled the late president's conviction that peace would be stronger than its enemies, and his certainty that peace would be maintained between Egypt and Israel, irrespective of who was in power. An unusual comment came from former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Just as he held the Carter administration to blame for the downfall of the Shah of Iran, Rabin placed moral responsibility for Sadat's assassination on the Reagan administration because of what he defined as its lack of interest in the Camp David Accords and in the Palestine autonomy talks, and because of its shift of American support from Sadat to Saudi Arabia. While most of Israel's political establishment joined with Prime Minister Begin in expressing grief over the death of Sadat, together with a hope that peace between the two countries would be preserved, a discordant note came from Israeli-occupied Sinai. Leaders of the Israeli settlers who are to leave their homes when the rest of the peninsula reverts to Egyptian sovereignty next April called upon the government to delay preparations for the withdrawal from Sinai. For them, as for other extremist nationalist circles in Israel, the assassination of Sadat provides an opportunity for Israel to go back on its signature on the Camp David Accords. For National Public Radio, this is Peretz Kidron in Jerusalem.
Forgetting all the political undertones, I'm just thinking what a crazy mixed-up society where human life is not valued, you know? Everybody's talking about the possibility of war and...
It seemed pretty inevitable that they were going to get him sometime. I was under the impression that Gaddafi was out to get him, and he's made a lot of enemies in the Middle East, so I had the feeling that eventually one of them would get through him sometime.
What did you think of him as a man?
I thought of him as an autocrat, but a good guy, basically.
Well, from what I knew about him, he seemed like a very inspired gentleman, a real pacifist, and an innovator, and I thought that he was a great hope for the Middle East and for the future. And now I really don't know what will be.
I recently saw a survey in the paper that indicated that he was the most admired world leader from people in this country, even more so than our own leaders. And I think that's indicative of the type of guy he was.
Well, it just gives you a sick feeling to hear or read about these things. And Reagan was almost killed. The Pope was almost killed. And now Sadat... Is dead.
I can't believe it. I was very upset this morning when I'd heard on the radio that they had even attempted to assassinate him, and I was just hoping against hope that he would survive. I'm really saddened. I think he was probably one of the finest leaders that the Middle Eastern countries have, and I'm just very upset. I keep reading it over and over and over, and I can't believe it.
Disbelief, and the list gets longer and longer. Some men and women in New York City speaking with NPR's Neil Conan about the death of Anwar Sadat.
The key to the man was that journey that he made under Nasser. I mean, living in Nasser's shadow, being Nasser's man. And then here's a man who turns around and begins to undo the legacy of his predecessor.
Fuad Ajami is the director of Middle Eastern Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
In his own mind, he becomes larger than his predecessor. And I think the fight had always been the really major issue for him. How does he relate to Nasser's legacy? Because on the one hand, he came to power as Nasser's successor. Yet on the other, he could not compete with Nasser, either in Egypt in some way, and definitely not in the Arab world. And so the search for a theater beyond Nasser was a search for the West. And it could be wrong, but I think this fight with his predecessor gives you a key to the character and the riddle and the frustrations of Anwar Sadat. And what's interesting about it, I mean, for me in some way, here is a man who becomes bigger than Egypt and then the country reclaims him, if you will. Mm. I mean, here is a man who, at the end of his journey, had ceased to even care or listen to anybody in his own society. And in a tragic way, I mean, I had written a piece where I said, you know, countries have ways of serving warrants on the rulers. And in a kind of sad and dramatic way, the army served a warrant on him. And what began in the army, the journey that begins in the army, a lower middle class young boy from the Egyptian Delta, goes to the army, becomes an officer, gambles it all in the kind of classic Egyptian way that, you know, you reach for power, joins the inner clique of this coup d'etat, becomes a pharaoh, becomes king, becomes emperor of the land, and then ceases to care about what anybody says and what anybody does in that country, as evidence in the last crackdown that he resorted to. And then, you know, this tragic thing.
He lived in the style of almost of an ancient Egyptian ruler, didn't he?
That's the fantasy of Muhammad Anwar Sadat. I mean, he had been poor. Take a look at the way he deals in his biography with his former wife. He had had another wife besides the more glamorous Jihana Sadat. She's obliterated. Take a look at the years he spent under Nasser. They're obliterated. They're simply just glossed over as a man constructs a fantasy of himself and, a kind of an image of what he would like to be. And see, the important thing about the American theater and the Western theater is that here was a theater where no one really knew the past of Anwar Sadat. And this is a place you could begin anew. And that was the seduction of America and the seduction of the West.
Hmm. How do you suppose he would want to be remembered? As this new Sadat or the older Sadat?
How would he like to be remembered? Probably from 1973 onward. Hmm. You know, the hero of war, the man who came in as Egypt was facing a major civilizational crisis, the man who has the guts to go to war, the man who has the guts to go and conduct peace, the man who gets the Nobel Peace Prize, and then the man who goes to Jerusalem, who has ways of transcending institutions, of going beyond institutions. And then, of course, you know, as the man who, in some way, I mean, so he would like to think, had redeemed Egypt from a massive civilizational and political crisis. If you go back, in his recollection of 52 to 1970, the coup d'etat to the death of Nasser, like he says, the revolution had gone wrong under Nasser. And those years were wasted years. They were years of resentment, of hate, of complexes, and so on. So that Nasser had somehow robbed him of the revolution, if you will.
And yet he owed everything to Nasser.
Right, see, he constructed a different idea of it all. Like, for example, because he had no power in the junta that pulled off the coup d'etat in 1952, he was given the assignment of going to the radio station and declaring, I mean, you know, communicating the first communique of the junta. But he took that, instead of saying that he had nothing to do with the, you know, nothing major in the revolution of 1962, as an example that he had always been the real leader of this revolution. And that Nasser's ego, Nasser's search for power, Nasser's, you know, dictatorship, Nasser's propensities had somehow relegated him to an inferior status. But he, of course, was a nobleman, so he is in his fantasy. And he wouldn't grub for power, so he lost. But then patience redeemed him, and he, a believer, a faithful man, waited, and his turn came. And he saw his way to Jerusalem, he saw his way to war, he saw his way to peace, he saw his way to an alliance with America. It's, you know, the right of vision, that he is the man who, you know, who simply saw what had to be done, and he did it.
Fuad Ajami, Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. He spoke with us from New York of a man he's watched and written widely about, Anwar Sadat.
it seems that President Sadat himself looks very happy, very relaxed. When he got off the plane, he moved down the line of people, and he found Sharon, he found Dayan, and he found Golda Meir, and he shook hands particularly warmly with
think
those three.
More than 70% of our problem was this psychological wall that has been built between us. By my visit, I think we have brought this wall down. If my visit achieves this, and I have already gave the message to the Knesset and through the Knesset to the
Israeli
people.
We came to Camp David with all the goodwill and faith we possess, and we left Camp David a few minutes ago with a renewed sense of hope and inspiration. Let us pledge to make the spirit of Camp David a new chapter in the history of our nations. Thank you, Mr. President.
The objective of President Sadat's political crackdown on Muslim extremists is becoming clearer by the day. The government intends to make sure that only moderate versions of Islam are disseminated in Egypt. President Sadat repeatedly says that true Islam has nothing in common with fundamentalist versions.
I told my people, whenever I feel hatred or ill will or jealousy or all this, whenever I feel this from anyone or from a magazine or from a newspaper, immediately I stop dealing with it. So at night, whenever I go to bed, let me tell you this. Maybe I am the only head of state in the world that doesn't sleep with sleeping pills until this moment.
President Sadat became very angry when an NBC television reporter asked him if he had consulted President Reagan before launching his current crackdown.
You have no right to ask this question, but I'm sorry, it is democracy, or I could have taken precautions against you. Really? The decision here is the Egyptian decision, and if Reagan discusses his internal problems with me, then maybe I may think of discussing my internal problems with him, but no one respects his responsibility, respects his people, respects his dignity, respects the dignity of his people, permits any other power to interfere in his decision.
Anwar Sadat, assassinated today. On Christmas Day, Sadat would have been 63 years old.
Susan, this was one of those events, I think, that captivated Americans from the moment that it broke this morning. There were people talking about it just almost everywhere, I think.
Yeah.
I took my car in for some repairs this morning, and to my surprise, I found car mechanics talking about this news that one of them had heard and was sharing with the other about Anwar Sadat having been shot.
Something else so curious that happens in this town, as everyone talks, the streets get so quiet. And I notice mostly we spend the day locked in here, following wires, making phone calls, our interviews. At around 2:15, 2:30 today, I was able to take a break, go downstairs to the snack shop next door, and get some coffee. And all the women behind the counter there, as they were pouring out coffee, dishing out donuts, whatever, stopped, looked up and said, "Is Sadat gone?" I said, "Yes." And there was nothing more said. They went back to putting the lids on the coffee cups, dishing out the donuts.
And for this evening, that's All Things Considered.
We had help tonight from member station WOI in Ames, Iowa.
Our executive producer is Stephen Reiner. Tonight's program was produced by Jim Angle, edited by Mark Rosenbaum, foreign news edited by Gary Covino.
Our director is Maurice Schlesinger. He was helped tonight by audio technicians Renee Pringle and Eric Epstein. Our funds come from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Sanford Unger. Good evening, for All Things Considered.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.